with a real wind chill feel to it. Friday, generally overcast, still feeling chilly, surprise, surprise, at 3 to 4 degrees in some places maximum. And then for over the weekend, for Saturday and Sunday, the outlook actually looks quite good. The sun should be out in full force, feeling slightly warmer, especially on Sunday, so you can get out of your house for a few hours. Monday, it'll be overcast, with chances of light rain in the early morning, but it should be dry the rest of the day. Tuesday, temperatures up a bit, with some sunny spells at intervals. Wednesday, it's going to be really bright, hopefully, with temperatures above normal at 6 to 7 degrees. And then Thursday, still some chances of a bit of sunshine, making it feel a little bit warmer than earlier on in the week, at about 4 or 5 degrees, and remaining dry. That's a roundup of the weather for the next week, brought to you by radiodialect.net. Now we've got a song by Ben Sinister called Fool to Love.
most importantly,
well,
there was you.
That was Band Sinister, Bend Sinister even, with Fool to Love. Just in case you missed it before, this is Radio Dialect, back on air for another week on Thursday the 26th of January. We're going to give you a roundup of this week's events and news with Richard Eyre next.
Yes, here we go. Oh, we've got a sound bed as well.
Sorry.
Oh no, it's gone. Oh, that's a shame. Anyway, more than a century of chocolate making in Bristol is to end following the announcement that the Elizabeth Shaw factory is to close. Most of the 160 strong workforce at the factory will be made redundant, and it is expected that production will finish in the autumn. The site at Greenbank in Easton will be sold off for redevelopment. Senior managers blame rival products being manufactured in Eastern Europe and the need to outsource production of the company's key brands, such as famous name chocolate liqueurs and Elizabeth Shaw mint crisps, as causes for the decision to close the factory. In its heyday, Elizabeth Shaw employed more than 2,500 people. The business started in Bristol in 1881, trading under the name of H.J. Packer, who had previously worked for Fry's in Bristol. He began making chocolate on Stapleton Road under the name of Packer & Co. And by 1901, the company had grown so huge that they needed a new factory in Greenbank. We have been part of the fabric of this community for over a century, and it is very sad to have to bring that relationship to an end, said Director Paul Keith. Where are we? Protesters who broke into a closed-down swimming pool say they will keep fighting for the building's future. More than 70 campaigners, including Bishopston councillor Bev Knott, met at a Gloucester Road cafe to share ideas about how to save Bristol North Baths in Bishopston. Last weekend, a group of nine climbed in through the rear window of the baths and spent more than 2 days barricaded inside. The group is campaigning against the closure of the city's swimming pools by the city council. They also protested against the privatisation of public services like buses. Police and security guards escorted five of the squatters from the building on Monday after a county court hearing granted the city councillor an order to retake possession of the pool, which closed last October after being open for 83 years.
Rich, I'd just like to add that the council accused the occupiers, who were only there for 2 days, of causing £5,000 worth of damage. This was actually caused by the council security men breaking into the... and for some strange reason... they seem to be trying to break out of almost every door to the swimming pool. So the £5,000 worth of damage, just to put the record straight, was caused by Bristol City Council security staff.
Goons.
Hiya, goons.
Yeah. Met them before. anyway, now campaigners, who've now been removed from the site, are now taking action to protect it. And they plan to talk to the council and members of the community to ask for help. And Mr. McGavock, who regularly used the pool, said, "We're still in the early stages of our campaign, but we want to focus on the future of the site." The group have criticised the sell-off of land in Bristol to private developers and said the city provides unsuitable temporary bed and breakfast accommodation for the homeless. We're going to want bits of paper now. Right. Now we have... there's a new book coming out. At last, the long-awaited Bristol book. 200 full-colour pages with nearly 500 different photos of stencils, murals, graffiti, subverts and other expressions, which their cameras have been collecting for 7 years. As New Labour continued to crack down on dissent, Bristol celebrates it. Whilst a few of these images have been published before, most of them haven't. Altogether, they show the real depth of street expression and art in the city, and to a degree, the ongoing political activism. It is bigger than just Banksy, although he has been a strong influence, and is included in the book too. Some of the issues covered show the level of outrage at war, or George Bush's visit to the country when the whole city was covered with messages and stencils. Some are very clever, some are very artistic, some very basic. Anyway, it's a bargain. £5 direct from the stalls or from Cabele on 14 Robertson Road, or you can send a cheque for £6, made payable to Bristol, to Bristol, care of 14 Robertson Road, Easton, Bristol, BS56JY. On Tuesday, there will be a public meeting to start a campaign to reclaim Bristol buses. Come along with your own ideas about how to get a better and more affordable public transport system. There'll be plenty of time for open discussion. That's at 8 o'clock at the Friends Meeting House on 300 Gloucester Road by the Neville Road bus stop on the 73, 75, 76, 77 and 99 buses. Coming up on the Friday the 10th of February, there'll be a gig at the Trinity Community Centre here, where we're broadcasting from, as an expression of opposition to the demolition of the lovely Ashley Court Hotel on Ashley Hill. That's at 10 p.m. to 4 a.m. Artists include Kid Carpet, Queen Bee, Chrissy Chris, Peter D. Rose, Kells, DJ Dad, Wan Dan, MC Idol, MC Fatal and Scoobs, Terrell Bacon, Ghost Boy and Anarchists. All proceeds will be going to the St. Werburgh's City Farm. And I've got another piece of paper somewhere.
Loads of pieces of paper there.
Eh? Yeah. Next Thursday is National Women's Day.
Woo!
It's only one day a year. There'll be Can-Can Girls performing at the Thekla, and there will be Lady DJs as well there too. So that'll be a good night. Isn't it normally at... Or was it last year's at the
somewhere
Malcolm
else.
X Centre?
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to that. That was very good. It was very good.
Did you convince them you were a girl with your long locks?
No, but I didn't try. Yeah. I did mistake someone for their sister.
A boy or a girl?
A girl.
Oh, right, that's not so bad.
No.
Okay. Thank you very much for that, Rich. Next week's weather will be cold, but a bit warmer later on in the week. Right, well, one way some people have decided to resist the wars British troops are fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan is to basically stop paying their taxes, or at least the parts of their taxes which pay for the wars. So, unfortunately, this doesn't mean all their tax, but they sit down and carefully work out exactly what proportion of their taxes goes to the military and withhold it, basically. Robin Brooks Baker is one of a group of seven individuals who have decided not to pay these taxes. He was actually supposed to come in and chat to us live on air a few weeks ago about this, but the door was locked when he got here. So instead, Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to him earlier on in the week about why he was taking this course of action.
I'm Robin Brooks, and I'm one of the Peace Tax Seven. Basically, we're a group of seven individuals who have been withholding a proportion of their taxes that they consider is the amount used by the government spent on war preparation. We believe that people with a deeply held conviction that war is wrong and that it is just as wrong to pay for war as it is to go and fight wars. And we believe that we should have the right not to pay for the preparations for war. So we are bringing a judicial review to basically... going to get stuck.
Well, what sort of stage is your case at? Because obviously the Inland Revenue will be on your case, won't they?
Yes, I mean, we are constantly being having to deal with... the Inland Revenue, because we're still withholding taxes. So,
what's the first thing that they do when you decide, well, I'm not going to actually pay this tax?
They send letters, basically. I mean, basically, what they do is not a whole lot. I mean, they just wait. They keep sending letters, sort of saying, well, you owe this amount, and you better pay it. We usually sort of send letters back, sort of saying why we're doing this and why we would like their assurance that the money's not going to be spent on war, and if they can do that, then we'll pay it. But we get just stock answers, if we get answers at all. They just go on and on. Eventually what they do is they bring a summons to go to Magistrates Court. For me it was like a year before they did that.
So when was that and what happened?
It was October of 2003. And I went to a trip in a Magistrates Court. They allowed me to say why I was withholding taxes, but basically a magistrate's court can't do much. I mean, they have to abide by the set of rules they've got. So, but they listened and they said, well, you know, sorry, but, you know, you'll have to pay up. And they gave me 3 months and warned me that, you know, if I didn't pay up, then bailiffs would come and take things. So
what happened then?
Well, then the long wait for 3 months till that was up. And then I got a sort of red letter. It's actually written in red print saying, you know, I had to pay up and they were the bailiffs. And if I didn't, then they were going to come and take goods and they would also charge me for the trouble of coming. So I sent letters to them sort of saying, well, you understand what this is about, and explained it all to them and sort of said, well, you know, you'll have to do your worst because I can't voluntarily hand the money over. I then waited more than a year before I got another red letter, and then they did actually appear fairly soon after that. By that time, I got a scheme to put the money up in £10 notes pinned to a board. It's about £600 onto a board. And I had a notice on this board that said every 10 seconds Britain spends this much in occupying Iraq. And I had other notices saying how best that money might be spent.
So did the Inland Revenue come and take your board away?
Basically the bailiff came and we had to unpin all the money. And we had quite a nice chat about war and peace. And I think he was fairly sympathetic, actually. But again, they're bound by regulation, their job and all the rest of it. So
how on earth do you decide what proportion of your tax is going to go on war, and so how much you should actually withhold? That must be a very difficult amount to actually put your finger on.
It's not too difficult because you can look it up on the web. The amount that's actually allocated for defence is about 10% of all taxes. Of course, income tax is only part of all taxes because also, you know, part of our VAT goes obviously into this big pool, this big bucket called the Consolidated Fund. So income tax goes in there, VAT, car tax, fuel duty, you know, you name it, all ends up in this great big bucket, of which 10% goes to the military.
So in a way, you've voluntarily really given that money up. By putting it on the board and allowing the bailiffs to come and then take it away, you have kind of really gone against your original principle, haven't you?
The point is they will get it anyway. What I want to do is make a point. So that was what I was doing at that time. I'm not quite sure how I'm going to deal with it next time. Because
so every year when a new bill comes in, you've got another sort of round of court cases and bailiffs?
Well, in fact, they've written this time to say that they don't actually need to go to court and they can just send the bailiffs round anyway. And I understand that is the case, that they can do that.
Is that for anybody, or is that only because you've had a court case already?
I'm not too sure about that. Possibly. They've already heard a court case. So, you know, why keep going back to court to hear the same thing?
Right. Well, that's interesting because I hadn't heard that before. What about the other six people in the Peace Tax 7?
Well, they're from all over the country. They're from different parts of the country, different ages, different professions. So we're quite a good mix of the British public. There's come from Wales, Sheffield, Hereford, Oxford.
And what do you do? What's your profession? Or are you employed, self-employed?
I'm a self-employed designer, mostly toys. And others in the group are different sorts of things. So we have retired headmistress. We've got a psychologist, we've got a journalist, we've got a university lecturer. Trying to think what they all do, really.
But what about the future of the campaign? Is it, you know, if it looks like it's not going to be all that successful if just simply every year the bailiffs come round each of the Peace Tax 7 and take away forcibly that goods to the value of the money that they're supposed to be paying in taxes, plus a little bit on top to cover the bailiff's expenses?
Well, this is why we're bringing the judicial review, because we believe that under Article 9 of the Human Rights Convention that we should be allowed to have our taxes diverted, to cut a story short.
When you say diverted, what do you mean? You mean you want your taxes to go to something peaceful, not the military?
That's basically it, yes. And what we're claiming under the under this Act, of course, is that simply that we should not be obliged to pay for killing. That's our bottom line. We've got all sorts of ideas as to how it might be better spent, but really our argument is that our conscience should not be compromised in this way, and that there's no need to, that in fact they could quite easily divert the money away from military use.
But Robin, at the end of the day, there's a democratic decision made to go to war, and really, who are you to say, well, I'm not going to go along with this?
It's a fundamental democratic principle that minorities should be accommodated wherever it is possible.
Well, you're entitled to your view, but surely you should have to pay your tax if there's a decision made that tax has to be paid.
Well, we want to pay the full amount of our taxes. We're not avoiding that at all. We're not asking to pay less tax. We want to pay the full amount. So basically what we're saying is that we shouldn't be obliged to pay for killing. I mean, if you go back to the beginning of conscription in 1916, at the very time that Act was put forward, there was also the right for conscientious objection. So there's already an established principle that conscientious objectors to going and fighting wars are, once they've proved that theirs is a genuine act of consciousness, that they don't have to go and fight. So there should be, you know, by extension, the right not to have to pay for it.
Right, could you introduce...
Radio Dialect is your local internet radio station. Check out our website on radiodialect.net.
Robin Brooks Baker there, who also on the side has a toy designing and making business near Devizes? In Wiltshire. Talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. Robin is withholding a proportion of his taxes from the inland revenue, the amount he believes to be used, he believes is being used for war preparations. Okay, now we've got a small local band for you called Portishead, or Portishead, as they're known around here, but I reckon they could do quite well. And the song is called Mr. Ons.
the lovely Porter's Head there and Mr. Ron's.
Dialect is Bristol's only internet current affairs programme on Radio Dialect at Trinity Radio.
Radio Dialect.net. Some people attack the Freemasons for doing all sorts of things behind the scenes. Some, on the other hand, congratulate them on their charitable works. However, how much of this is backslapping or paranoia, and how much can really be justified? Well, it's clearly in the nature of a secret society such as the Masons to make decisions behind closed doors, and there are very few people who can really uncover what the Freemasons want to keep secret. 2 years ago, however, Jerry Coulter had his car stolen in Dorset, and when he eventually got it back, he exposed a criminal conspiracy which involved the Freemasons and serving police officers, and he believes it was this that led to the resignation of the Chief Constable of Dorset. Dialect's Tony Gosling asked Jerry what he found out about what goes on behind the lodge door.
My name is Jerry Coulter. I'm a victim of Masonic ill treatment, and I've been looking at various aspects of it and how it affects people and wrecks their life since 1995.
Now, so what sort of different types of people do you find that come to you or that you come across who believe they've been affected by the Masons or that the Masons are persecuting them?
They're in three categories. First of all, I find the first category, half of them start raving bonkers. They're either conspiracy theorists. They might have started out as logical thinking people and over the years have deteriorated, or they were that way inclined to begin with. The second category is the person who has suffered an injustice, can't understand why, for example, the weight of the authorities have moved against them when they were a victim or something like that, and they can't understand what is going on or why they go up to the courts and the High Court judges won't give them a remedy or resolve their case, and they start thinking there's an underlying reason, but they don't know where to go, and they end up ranting and raving, and they can't logically look for common denominators and research it. The third person, which is probably maybe 0.6 of a decimal point in terms of percentage, they are a logistician, a logical thinking person who will actually take the time to research, find the common denominators. If it is Masonic, find out who the people are that are Freemasons, find out their lodge numbers, find out what's orbiting it and what are the actual factors in relation to why they've got a case.
How did you get involved yourself?
Oh, I got involved myself. That was a long story because I was the victim of a car theft. And instead of Dorset Police impounding a car that should have been impounded, it was given to a car dealer without logbooks, and when they knew I was the legal owner, instead of impounding it, they told me that it was a civil matter, which I was still happy to fight a civil case for recovery of a stolen vehicle, even though it was a criminal matter, and dishonest handling of a stolen car and taking a car without the owner's consent is a criminal offence. The only thing is, I couldn't get a civil order for delivery up of the car unless the police impounded the car away from the bent Masonic car dealer that had my car in Dorset. Otherwise, he'd just chop it up and report it stolen as soon as I got judgment against him, which, of course, the police allowed him to do.
Well, just tell us a bit more about that case. What happened?
Well, exactly that. I've applied to the High Court for an Order 14 for the delivery up of the car. And as soon as the Order 14 was settled and the proceedings were served on the car dealer that had bought my car from the thief, his brother was a serving Dorset police officer who was also a member of a Masonic lodge in Dorset. Dorset police refused to impound the car, as I say, forced me to take a civil recovery for the vehicle instead of impounding it under Section 19 of PACE. And then when the guy reported it stolen, which he was bragging to me he would do, and which I'd written to the police chief constable and everybody else telling them that this was going to happen, as far as I was concerned, the police had caused the second theft of the car, which was a criminal offence, because the police had actually aided and abetted and caused a car theft instead of stopping one, which was misconduct in public office and a criminal offence. Then I came into contact with other people who were also saying that they were victims of Dorset Police and that the whole thing was Masonic. So I made a point of getting hold of Dorset Masonic yearbooks with all their lodge numbers. Then I could find out who all the people were that were in post at the time that were causing so much distress to other people. And, of course, I could show their lodge numbers and that the whole thing does have a Masonic overtone. What makes me different from other conspiracy theorists is even when you establish these people are Freemasons and even when you show their lodge numbers, unless you're actually in the lodge at the time when they're conspiring against you, you still haven't got a conspiracy.
So what do you do in that kind of case?
Publish it. The only thing you can do is publicise it. There's no point going to the High Court because the civil judges there are paid huge salaries to keep the lid on it. They're not there to provide you with a remedy. That's the first thing members of the public don't realise. The second thing I don't realise is that ombudsmen, commissioners, High Court judges, they're all paid huge salaries. They're just fat cats on huge public money, and they're there to keep the lid on everything. They're not there to give you a remedy. They're there to stop all this breaking out. And the reason that these people can do this to victims year in, year out, is because most people cannot get it published in the local press, the national press. They can't get it on TV, and they don't know where to go with it.
So how widespread do you think this is?
I think it probably is very widespread. I think it, to a greater or lesser degree, it goes across the whole of the UK. Obviously, in backwaters like Dorset, as opposed to where I live in Hertfordshire, you've got other problems because the authorities are incestuous. I mean, we don't have the same problem here. When I say they're incestuous, for example, you had the Deputy Chief Constable of Dorset in the 90s, Sue Davis. Her husband worked for the County Council. He was a senior solicitor in the County Council Legal Department. Also, his lodge number appears in the Dorset Masonic yearbook. His name was Mike Davis. Mike Davis, being married to the Deputy Chief Constable, was then operating a service level agreement to give Dorset Police legal services, even though he was married to the Deputy Chief Constable of Dorset. And the county councillors and the stupid chief executive of the council, who was also had a conflict of interest because he was also clerk to the police authority, which gave him extra salary, all of them had an incestuous conflict of interest to allow this to happen. At the minimum, it was unethical, and at the maximum, it was illegal.
At what point did you realise that you had enough information to actually do something about this, that this was really going to be rather than just a conspiracy, that you didn't have enough information on, that you were going to be able to do something about it? When did you realise you'd managed to turn the corner?
When I realised I managed to turn the corner is that what I realised, the two things, the biggest weapons you've got against these people is they don't like the truth to be published. They don't want you handing it out to elected members, councillors, MPs. Don't like you distributing it to people like shopkeepers, for example, if you publish it in leaflet form, because shopkeepers talk to other members of the community. Also, you throw something through the letterbox of a shop, a shopkeeper will read it. You put it in the letterbox of someone's house, 90% of them end up in the bin. You know, what they don't like is a logical publicity campaign. And the whole reason why is because the truth hurts. If, for example, if you get caught with your hand in the biscuit barrel stealing biscuits and you say to someone, hey, you're stealing biscuits, you might find that offensive. And that is exactly what they find it when they accuse you of being offensive and being insulting when you're just publicising their shortcomings and what they're doing.
Now, your case went right to the top in the media in a way, didn't it? Because you got a BBC documentary made.
No, I didn't get a BBC documentary made in my own case. What happened was, because there was the Masonic overtones and people saying that certain Freemasons are exempt from the law and that people can get planning permissions that other people can't get, I made the point of, once I had the Dorset Masonic yearbooks, I trawled all of the planning records, found out how many councillors were Freemasons and in what lodges they were in. Then I found out what property developers constantly have planning applications up in front of their own brethren, that, and I'm not talking about just Masons, these are people who are in their same lodge, so they can't say they don't know the councillor that's sitting on the planning committee and voting through his application. Those people should stand down, they should withdraw. Those people are supposed to declare an interest and have nothing to do with it. Instead, we actually got a camera in and filmed one of them voting through his mate's planning application of a property developer having a contentious planning application passed.
Now, at that point, he really should have declared an interest and stepped out of the committee, should he?
Yeah, under Section 5.9 of the local government, it was the local code of conduct for local government, which is how elected members should behave. It stated that they have to declare a membership of Freemasonry, trade unions or Freemasonry. That is the actual wording of what was paragraph 5.9. Since in the wake of that programme, a new code was issued almost immediately when I started saying that the failure to do that, if you breach a code of conduct, that amounts to misconduct. Misconduct in public office is an indictable criminal offence. It's not a matter for the local government ombudsman. It's not maladministration. If you breach a code of conduct, it is misconduct. Misconduct is a criminal offence.
Successful Freemasonic investigator Jerry Coulter there, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling. And his websites, again, there are two of them, are www.dorsetvictimsupport.org and, rather ironically, www.policeinefficiency.com. Okay, next up we've got Jeff Sparks and his What Song Guide and Song of the Week.
Thank you. Good evening. This is your weekly What's On Guide from Radio Dialect. Let's start off with telling you about tomorrow night. Now, the Reckless Engineer in Bristol, they have a night of classic rock covers performed by the Tone Devils. Entry is free and the band should be on stage around 9:30 p.m. Also, tomorrow night, and this time at the Bristol Carlin Academy, the co-founder of Velvet Underground, John Cale, will be performing with his band. Tickets are £15 in advance, and the gig should start around 6:30 p.m. Moving on to Saturday night, and at the Old Duke in King Street, Bristol, the popular and very talented local singer-songwriter Pete Rowe will be performing with his band. Entry is free, and the gig should start around 9 p.m. Now on to Song of the Week, and the honours go to the blues covers band Highway Blues. This is from the 7-track CD and is titled Tore Down.
Jump in, but baby showed up and said, I will tell you when. Well, I'm tore down, I'm almost level with the ground. Well, I feel like this when my baby can be found. I love you, baby, with my heart and soul. A love like mine will never grow old. I love you in the morning and in the evening too, but every time you leave me I get mad with you. Well, I'm tore down, I'm almost level with the ground. Well, I feel like this when my baby can be found. I love you, baby, with all of my mind. A love like mine is out of sight. I'd die for you if you want me to. I really don't believe that your love is true. But I'm tore down, I'm almost level with the ground. Well, I feel like this when my baby can be found. Thank you.
you, baby, with all my heart. A love like mine will never grow old. I love you in the morning and in the evening too. But every time you leave me, I get mad with you. Well, I'm tore down, I'm almost level with the ground. Well, I feel like this when my baby can be found.
That was Highway Blues with Tore Down. For more information on the band, check out www.highwayblues.info. Finally, I come to Sunday, and at the Colston Hall in Bristol, the popular rock band Thunder will be performing. Support comes from ex-Little Angels singer Toby Jepson and also Roadstar. Tickets are £18.50 and the gig should start around 8 p.m. Also on Sunday at the Old Duke, one of the best blues guitarists in Bristol, Eddie Martin, will be performing with his blues band. Entry is free and the gig should start around 8 p.m. That's all from me this week, so I hope you have a good weekend and take care. Good night.
Radio Dialect. Transmix. Radio Dialect. Transmix. Radio Dialect. Transmix.
Radio Dialect. Transmix.
Hello, this is Dialect, and I'm Stanley Forbes, and I've written a song about the week's events, as I like to do, which I finished about 20 minutes ago, so we'll see how it goes.
A whale came swimming the Thames on a mission to deliver a petition signed by the Commission of North Sea Waves. It outlined the causes in various clauses of all the attrition of pollution and fishing that threaten the existence of his kind. And the whales chose their greatest mind for this deed, but when he never returned, they decreed this must be an act, declaration of war. It must be what the humans have killed our brother for. But they didn't realize that he drowned on the used condoms and strawberry bonbons in the river. So the whales united where the sea meets the land, and they attacked in formation according to their battle plan. They swam towards London until they got to the West End, sucking up the water until they'd all swallowed the Thames, and they spat out the condoms and strawberry bonbons and crisp packets and tennis rackets and L shopping trolleys and poo, and we spat it all over the town till all of the people of London drown. They are drown.
Thank you very much. You're very, very marvellously kind and very splendid and stuff. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Stanley Forbes there with a song about Wales and people in London dying. Well, it's nearly 8 o'clock and the end of this week's show, but before we finish, I'd just like to thank everybody who was involved in this week's show. That would be Richard Ayres, Anna Yardley, Jeff Sparks, this week's producer, Tony Gosling, and Stanley Forbes. Dialect is a community access co-op. Oh, and Gav in. Dialect is a community access co-op, so if you'd like to help produce one of our programmes, please do get in touch. Have a chat to Volunteering Bristol on Royal Oak Avenue, just off Queen's Square, or you can call them on 0117 989 7733. And you can also stay in touch via our website, which is www.radiodialect.net. And not radiodirect.net, as somebody made the mistake of last week, which is a French radio show. From the Dialect team in Trinity Community Arts Centre in Bristol, this is Chloe wishing you a very good evening. So whether you're listening live or on our podcast, download, please do have a very good week until we're back with you for another live show, as you can tell, with more on the London bombings next Thursday at 7 p.m.